Welcome to the CEN Show, a platform where we learn from the world. Community. I'm your host, Asi Maskani, and on the panel at this moment is Amin-Ra, Brother Ahi. Our guest this evening came on before. This is his second. It was October 9th, 2005. It's Daryl Brooks. He's a licensed clinical social worker. And the presentation we did with him in October, I thought was very good. He had an excellent presentation, and I wanted him to come back. And plus, you're in your 30s, correct?
Yes,
Okay,
32.
so he's nice and young man. I consider myself young, but a lot of people may not, but I consider myself pretty young, under age of 61. But that's me. But I wanted to just, before I get started with his presentation, the topic tonight is medical versus mental health stigma. So I want to show everybody the show so we could, so in this case somebody wanted to see this, we did with him before. Everybody could check that out. So I'm gonna show the video. Go to Meditation Network on YouTube and you can see it. And there it is. That's the show we did on October 29th, 2025. So now check it out. All right. So Daryl, I appreciate you coming back, and we will get started with your presentation.
All right. Well, I want to thank you guys for having me back. I know we had a call, and he was like, "Hey, man, we want to have you back and bring up some good mental health topics." So my goal is to always shed light about mental health and raise the vibration in that way. So I know we don't have all night, so I'm gonna just get straight to it. And then there's a good chance that I may not go over everything, but just enough that matters. So when we talk about stigma, and can you guys hear me?
Yes.
So when we talk about stigma, we're just talking about a scenario where a person has a misconception about how something works. So, one medical stigma or misconception, for example, that was in the past was an example of like HIV. When HIV first came out, or at least when it was first publicized, one of the first things that people thought was that if someone has HIV and they touch you, they cough, something like that, then you'll have HIV as well. And we all know that that's incorrect. But the stigma associated with it, or the negative connotation associated with it, was so strong that you couldn't tell a person otherwise, and it carried on for generations. So we know that stigma is damaging, messaging is powerful, and we know that the wrong stigma could damage generations just off misinformation. So the thing that we're going to talk about today is really dealing with men. All men, not just black men, but of course, if black men benefit from this information, that'll be great. But I am talking about men and also black men. But so when we talk about stigma, we're talking about a scenario where we're looking at that almost 70 plus percent of suicides in the US usually come from just men. And that's worrisome simply because we're looking at what are the reasons why men are committing suicide. And sometimes a person may commit suicide off of just sheer, like, I no longer want to be here. But if you ever peel back and actually talk to someone that has very, very much so ideations, you're going to look at a lot, some of it is stigma. Stigma was the root of it. So one of the things, the talking points I'm going to explain today is how emotional suppression impacts mental health. How connected stigma to untreated depression and anxiety impacts his people, and discussing the importance of normalizing emotional vulnerability. And if I have more time, I can go to deeper points, but this is what I'll just talk about today. So when we start talking about emotional suppression, we're talking about a person having trauma, a trigger, or an issue, and they're making efforts to suppress and avoid. One of the biggest things that happen in men or in the Black community is toxic masculinity, and we're taught to not cry, to not worry, to not do anything but move forward. We're taught that productivity trumps everything. That if something happens to you, just keep moving. The problem with that is when you suppress things, you don't process, you don't address, now we start getting negative behaviors, such as drugs, such as porn, such as gambling, all these avoidant behaviors because people are suppressing. Now I'm gonna ask you guys, since we are on this call, when you were younger, how were you guys, and we are different generations, but how did you guys look at emotions and suppression? Like, do you feel like you guys were taught to like just keep going, like don't cry, don't any of that, and like mental health was for weakness, or what were some of the things in your generation you feel like was taught to you guys based on like how you should move forward with yourself in terms of your emotions?
Brother,
Well, when you fall down, you get back up. I think a lot of what we were taught was basically how to survive.
Survival.
These were survival skills. And weakness, you could be a victim. I think that we weren't so hung up on men don't cry. Although I think the first time I saw my father cry, I was so my mama's passing. But it wasn't, but we knew. I mean, I guess it was something that was ingrained in us growing up, and examples of men crying and or showing any type of weakness and not. And not continuing and being able to push through the process of grieving and or any type of stress show weakness. So it was about when you fall, get up, and if you fall again, get up again. Try, nothing beats a failure. Beat you, a failure, but I mean beats you, failure, but not trying again. So those were some of the lessons I took as a child coming up. Tenacity, follow through, be mentally tough, fight through it, and there were definitely roles, more clearly defined between the male and the female, not only from your emotional state, but your physical, how you look, how you present yourself. So these were the lessons I took up. As far as suppressing, yeah, sometimes people don't want to hear you why. Why? Just like what's the saying today? Complaining is not going to do you any good, so you're just going to push through it. There's no need to tell people what your problems are, how you feel about it emotionally, because don't nobody want to hear it. So go ahead and push right on through it. So, you know, those type of things coming through the 60s and the 70s.
But you know that point right there, people say, well, I'm not gonna complain, there ain't nobody listening anyway. But I always tell him, I said, go ahead and express yourself because it's therapeutic.
It is. It make me feel better.
I said, you can do it. Go ahead. But I just, and I said, kind of joke, I guess it is. It's, you're getting something off of you. Yeah. So, yeah, that's interesting.
So thank you for sharing that. And there's some there's a few things I want to add to what you're saying. So you describe a scenario in the 60s and the 70s of you were taught to be autonomous, independent out of the idea of survival. You're in a you're you should survive above anything else. You survive before you fail. I do believe that the world is similar to that now. It's just a little different because of technology, because policies have been advocated for, laws or more laws. There's more access to things. There's a different fight that's happening, but I do believe that that's still somewhat there. Now, the only thing about all that is it goes in two different ways. It goes from if when you survive, you we look at it as okay, survival is to not be a victim, and to make sure I'm not a victim, I don't go through the stages of grief about anything. Because grief has five stages: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. I won't go through each one of those, but that's the grief process. And grief is not just bereavement. Bereavement is a type of grief. So what happens with a lot of times, if you're taught to suppress, we're looking at grief as you have denial, maybe a little bit of denial about what happened. I can't believe this happened. And you should go all the way straight to acceptance. You don't need to be depressed. You don't need to bargain. And you don't need to be angry. You just need to accept. And the problem is, those three stages is what you need to make sure that you keep balance. And when they don't happen, or when they are overlooked, you get other things such as hypervigilance, such as increase of disassociating with the issues, which is drugs or whatever. And then that leads to this current generation, which is, I wouldn't say they're completely different from previous generations, where this generation has, and we're talking maybe millennials, Gen Zs, and after, they have what we call a crash out, sometimes can have a crash out mentality, which means the way I feel is so absurd that I don't necessarily want to commit suicide, but I do want to go out with a bang. I want to express my emotions in a out with a bang. Which is why you see stuff in the news where you see someone, it could be an extremist killing someone or killing a partner for not understanding them, or as meaningless as someone killing someone over a video game or a hot dog, something that like doesn't make sense. But it's because they're not going through the grief process about these different issues, and they're identifying that this is the way I can get all my anger or my expressions out in this one moment, and I'm gonna unload this onto you. And it turns out to be a crash out. So in your generation, it was a little bit more about survival, but in this generation, there's a culture of wanting to feel, and if you don't, and not, and if that person not felt enough, then it could come with a crash out. And
Do
that
you
is
think they're taking a more feminine, what used to be looked at when we looked at coming up as more feminine type of characteristic to want to share that or want to be felt, as a matter of fact? I want you to feel me. I want you to understand me. I'm more sensitive to that type of feeling from you. Receive me. Be more receptive to what I'm telling you. Whereas in my generation, it was like, well, if you hear me, you hear me. If not, I can show you better than I can tell you, and let's move on.
Your question is, what was that question?
The question is, today's process involves understanding being felt, you feeling me, and what my dilemma is. Whereas when I was growing up, yeah, you got a little bit of sympathy, but come on. It's not so much about your emotion. And that was more of a female characteristic when I was coming.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I do believe that to understand mental health is to tap into empathy. So the different, so when we say, is it feminine or masculine? It's about learning about empathy. Empathy can be a masculine or feminine trait. It's a neutral trait. But I do believe that what a lot of men believe is that if I push you to your hardest limit, if I push you to be great, if I push you in this way and give you a rigorous setup, that when life happens, I put you in such a rigorous environment that nothing else could be able to can hurt you. The problem is, if life never puts them in that rigorous situation, then you've created a trauma, or you create an environmental trauma when it was never really destined for them. So I think that we undercut people and believe that because I should be training them this certain way, and if I don't have them prepared, then they're going to be feminine or they're going to be not prepared for life. But one thing we have to trust people with is that we have to be able to teach mainly about adaptability. A person can be empathetic, and as long as they learn adaptability, they can adjust to anything. But I can see how a person could view that can view being empathetic as feminine because it's a different mindset. You do have to have more communication, and you do have to be more in tune and aware of yourself. The other way of thinking is just about productivity. And I'll give one example. In the 60s and 70s, if your father came home every day, fed and brought home money to your mom, took you out on the weekends, and allowed you to do things, not whether they did it with you, but they gave you the permission to go do things, that may have been considered a good dad. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, I want Professor Ra to kind of answer that question you put out.
As opposed to today, though, he never got to that.
And then today it's about that's not enough. This generation wants to know, do you commit the time towards me? There's a concept called the 5 A's. It talks about attention, acceptance, appreciation, affection, and allowing. It's a whole model. But that's what people look for now. Do you allow? Allow means to know my deep visions, values, and morals. Do you give me proper attention, which is considered mindful attention? Do you give me proper affection? Do you accept me, and etc.? And if you're not providing the 5 A's, people are going to be aware of that now because they have more access to mental health psychology terms, terminology, and interpretations. And they're going to identify it as that you did not put enough effort in to allow or accept me or appreciate me or whatever. So it does take more work nowadays to retain a relationship than it did 30, 40 years ago. 30, 40 years ago, you only had to consider a person's livelihood in terms of survival. Now you have to consider the whole being. And that's the difference.
Currently in a technological age where a lot of people spend a whole lot of time in front of the computer. And then when we were growing up, we spent a whole lot of time with interpersonal skills and learning to be around each other and learn how to work in groups and with each other, eye contact, physical contact, in each other's presence. That's something that it's you would see that type of attention being spent on interpersonal relationships today as opposed to yesterday when we actually spent a lot of time with each other.
So let's get Professor Chime in on that.
First, appreciate you coming on, Brother Brooks.
Yes, appreciate it.
And your insight. You started out talking about stigmas. Now, you're talking about generational stigmas or individual stigmas or both?
So we're talking about stigma in general, and the topic here we're talking about a little bit more is about men and associated with stigma. And the talking point right now I'm talking about is explaining how emotional suppression impacts mental health in regards to stigma.
Yeah, people have nervous breakdowns all the time, and but I don't see a whole, you know, there's a thing called democratic insanity where everybody vote is doing abnormal behavior that is normal and it becomes normal, you know. But, you know, from that standpoint, but what I'm concerned about is getting clarity, because it seems like we're dealing with mental health from a social standpoint, using sociological and social science principles rather than psychological principles. Is that correct?
So could you elaborate on what do you mean by we're using social instead of psychological principles?
Well, generally, to deal with mental health, you either be diagnosed by the psychologist or psychiatrist.
Yeah.
You know, now, a lot of people don't go and get diagnosed. They just walk. Some are homeless. Some parents used to just hide them in the closet, or when friends come over, put them in another room, and things of this nature. People used to deal with mental illness that way. But I'm thinking you're thinking about when you start talking about generational, it's group stigma. Like this generation didn't play with each other because of electronics and. Because they didn't develop a human relationship, you know, their relationship with their machines, and they, matter of fact, they're talking about mental health affecting so many people because of the social media addiction and things of this nature, and that's what I'm getting from. Your concept of stigma, and then at the same time, like just taking a kid's phone or taking their iPad, they have, you know, they go berserk. You know, it's worse than a whipping. They rather have the whipping, and then you take away that, and then, you know, we used to take cars away from kids if they act up. You had something to control their behavior. But when they get into depression, I think that's an individual thing. And what depressed one person may uplift another person. You know.
That's actually my next talking point.
Well, go ahead with it.
Okay, so the second talking point would be connecting stigma to untreated depression and anxiety. So to add to what you're saying, there's a lot of depression and anxiety that goes untreated. And there's a strong belief that stigma is the reason why it's avoided. Screenings, doctor's visits, all that.
So what you're saying is people do not seek consultation or treatment because they don't want to be stigmatized as having mental problems.
So when we say this, we're saying that because of stigma, a person would not make something, would not recognize something as depression. It's like if a person is in the house and they are fatigued, they are lethargic, they're not coming outside, they're not doing this, not doing that. And let's just say they're playing video games all day or they're doing something all day. A person would say, oh, this person is playing video games all day. They're video game addict, or they're doing this whatever they're doing all day. They're that. But we have to understand the video games, for example, is the self-medicating factor of what they may be feeling, and that's the depression. But the stigma part is, if I let someone know that I have a problem, how now will my life change? How would I be treated? How would I be seen? How I'll be viewed? And that comes from how society looks at mental health, and also that family. So because of the association of what depression could mean for someone, or anxiety mean for someone, that's going to limit them from wanting to do it. And I'll give another example. Actually, this might be another example that's controversial, but I'm going to say it anyway. It's like the difference between monogamy and polyamory. Most people that are Christian, or whatever the religion they're associated with, view monogamy as between two people, and et cetera. Polyamory, multiple partners. But in this United States, monogamy is the most dominant viewpoint of a relationship. So to do any other type of relationship, unless you are like in Islam or different things like that, is viewed as a negative connotation. So if you were to go to someone and say, "Hey, I have two wives in America," and you're not Muslim, or you don't have a religion that allows that, you're viewed as maybe a negative or a bad person. You have to have a reason why you're allowed to have that. So I'm not trying to say anything is wrong with any of those dynamics, but I'm saying if a person wanted to practice polyamory, for example, and they wanted to be accepted by their family, because of the negative connotation with it, they might not even attempt it. And that might be the way that they express themselves in a relationship. And I gave that example because that's what this person wants to be aware about and express, but they feel like this is negative to showcase to others because of the society or relational beliefs or the family beliefs. So therefore, I won't even say anything about it.
So stigmas aren't always dealing with falsehoods or untruths. Could there be some reality to a stigma?
Well, yeah, it could be a rea it could be reality, but usually stigma is about just a misunderstanding of something. So that one example I just gave you is how a person that's looking at depression or anxiety and how they're going to be perceived may be looking at it that similar way. Like, I want to get help for it, but I don't want to be seen or viewed through my social construct as being a problem, or that I have this issue with me. I don't want my job to know, I don't want my family to know, and I don't want to accept this at all, that's my reality, because it shouldn't be happening to me. So the whole untreated depression part and anxiety part, a lot of times come from stigma, and you have a lot of people that are just not aware of what the symptoms are and what it could mean for them. You have a lot of people self-medicating, going to jail, being addicted to things, and not realizing that, oh, it's untreated depression, it's untreated anxiety. I'm trying to chase dopamine. I'm trying to chase the feeling of serotonin through dopamine. We talked about social media, social media, that is the chase for dopamine once you start doom scrolling. And somebody that's depressed would doom scroll for hours to try to get dopamine when they really need serotonin. And they need to have more of a mood stabilization, which is the effect of an antidepressant. So I'm bringing up depression, anxiety, because that's the two most common diagnoses from people. But the stigma part is what prevents us from being aware about something or making an attempt towards it. It's like the first door leading to the pathway to get treatment. So what needs to kind of happen now is having these conversations, having more community involvement with mental health, and having groups that allow men specifically to talk more about how they're feeling and how things are going. Most of the suicides that are happening, if you ever go back into their life and look, there was at least almost 6 months to a year of misinterpretations of mental health and them reaching out in different ways that wasn't direct. Instead of someone saying, hey, I feel really bad, man, I don't want to be here, it was them picking up this bad behavior. It was them sending out messages for things that didn't make sense. So I do believe that if we could create spaces that reduce stigma, having more conversations through men talk groups, promoting the reading of social and psychological literature, and all those things, you reduce stigma and you open a pathway to make it more current and more accepting to do so. So if we control the acceptance part or accepting social acceptance part, we control the stigma. You kind of get what I'm saying about that?
Yeah, I understand clearly what you're saying. With that, we've had Black Men Build representation on here. They do a men's talk every month. I attended two of those, and I think it's a great thing too. And with getting more education about how things are going, you're a professional here and talking about these issues with more understanding, I think it'll help real, you know, it'll help people, you know, get the help that they need. So yeah, I think it's
They have this show on the, and to add to what you're saying, they have this show called The Chi. I don't know if you guys ever watched it. It's on HBO, I think. Might even be on Stars now. But The Chi is a show about Chicago, like African American individuals in Chicago and like how they live their lives. It's a drama, but it's still a pretty good show. The one thing I like about it, and I believe this was in season 3 or 4 or something, they had a talk space where men got together, at least 6 to 10 men got together, and they talked about and held each other accountable. And that same idea is what comes from a concept called your third spot. Your third spot is, what is the third spot you go to in your life the most? And the first spot is home. The second spot is work. The third spot is where? So your mental health a lot of times is determined by your third spot. So do you go to a family member's house? Do you go to a bar? Do you go, what is the first place you go to? If you got free time, where's the first place you go to? And so what we found is that if your third spot is in community or around other men, you have a less likelihood of having severe mental health issues because you have immediate support. If your third spot is complete isolation, unless it directly works for you, there's a good chance that you're going to have some issues if you haven't found other alternative ways to process how you feel. So your third spot that you go to in your life should be community. And the last thing I'm going to say about depression, anxiety, I do believe that if we could, I think that it's up to everyone. I mean, it's up to professionals. I don't think it's everyone's job to per se promote mental health. Everybody's job. Everybody has their own thing that they specialize in. I'll just say lastly that when we start talking about anxiety attacks, panic attacks, things like that, because things have happened, we need to just make sure that we take the signs of things. The signs, the symptoms, well, technically the symptoms, but the signs of panic attacks, the signs of anxiety attacks, the signs of feeling lethargic. And we need to make sure we just act a little bit more on that and not look at social acceptance over symptoms. So this is now social acceptance versus symptoms. If we have the symptoms, we act. We don't worry about social acceptance. Because if we worry about social acceptance, we now going to be forced into social acceptance, because now if you're in the hospital or you're on a video crashing out or your whatever has happened, now you're out in the public anyway, because the things that led up to you to maybe be hospitalized or led up to you to need that help, and now you're acting out, or you have crashed emotionally, or you have a crash in an angry way, it's going to be out anyway. So when people think they're going to avoid or hide what's really going on inside, it's not going to happen. It's going to come out.
Answer me a question.
Yes.
Different eras,
yeah,
have different normalities, or what they consider to be normalities for that era.
Yeah.
Like what people was doing in the 20s, and then people in the 30s and the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. For instance, we didn't have social media. We didn't have cell phones and iPads in the 60s. So our anxiety, depression, and things of this nature. But we did have group sessions to deal with things.
What far more socialization, yeah.
Yeah, and today, what some people consider people who, one thing that was there in the 60s, was there in the 20s and 40s, was religion.
Yeah.
And that's the biggest contributor to emotional issues in many ways. They call it spiritual, but it's mental. And so there's a lot of people think if you believe that you're going to go to heaven or you're going to fly away without an airline ticket, or that Jesus cures people or heals people, or that he's still alive if there was ever a Jesus, they look at you like, let me get an example. I can go in a corner and start talking to myself, and people say, you got a problem, buddy. But if I go in that corner and start saying, dear Heavenly Father, I love you, baby, I love you, you say, oh, he's just praying. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I get what you're saying. So that actually adds to my last point here, which is the talking point is discussing the importance of normalizing emotional vulnerability. So I like how when you bring things up, it's almost turning to my next point. So you're right. The church or religion or spirituality has always been a sense of vulnerability for a lot of people and men. I do feel like a lot of men are turning away from church for many different reasons. But it was a space for emotional vulnerability. Now I think it's been swapped with wellness groups, book clubs, any type of interest groups that meet for any type of progressive reason. So I think they have been alternated for that. But the last thing I'll say is those things actually can be helpful, especially if it's going to be like you talked about social media. Social media, we think that social media has made people more sociable, but it's made us less sociable because we're not out doing, we're just showcasing. Showcasing is not the same thing as doing. So it just highlighted showcases. So emotional vulnerability is less because you're not doing, like you just said, in the 70s and 80s, 90s, they had groups, they had a lot of meetups. You could probably find a meetup anywhere in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And when you go out into a neighborhood, people were actually outside walking around. You go outside at 6 o'clock in Atlanta, wherever, Chicago, LA, people are outside. So, and nowadays, most people are inside. The only time you see a person outside is they're walking to their car or walking somewhere, or kids playing outside. Rather than that, there's no one outside. So social media and technology has contributed to that. But in terms of emotional vulnerability, I do believe that people have adapted and they're now more interest and wellness center about how they meet group wise. It's just that the only problem is because it's not done in a large wave in drones, you have a lot of people that are going to be left out. So let's just say if we had a population of a million people that was 21 to 40 in a city, and out of those million people, 700,000 of those people would get up on a weekly basis in these different groups. Because of social media, that might be cut down to 3 out, 4 out of 10, unless it's the weekend. So there's no like consistent interaction with groups and community that encourages emotional vulnerability. And also that example you gave about where if you're in church, I mean, church gave you a better explanation for being able to have emotional vulnerability. I do believe that now people are redirecting themselves from church because they feel like they have alternative ways to have emotional vulnerability. But they also missing the fact that everything has its place. The mind, body, and spirit. They're replacing emotional, the things they learn psychologically and socially with spiritual teachings, and that should be separate. The only problem with some religious groups is that they're not really teaching intuitive knowledge and wisdom, which is really what separates the psychology from the spirit. So because they're not getting intuitive wisdom and knowledge, they just decided, well, I'm not going to actually learn something here from an intuitive or wisdom standpoint. I'll just focus on emotional vulnerability and awareness, and I'll just focus on that. But I'll just say that.
Okay. Look, that this type of information is necessary. And there could be a lot said about the versus, belief of knowledge. And it's just a lot. Just going into the taking the word belief, investigating it, and making sense. So this is Professor, you have anything else? And Rahi, before we leave.
No, you answered all everything I have.
Yes, very well spoken, very well informative, very well put.
Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah, I appreciate Daryl because
All right, so the only thing, oh, go ahead. Can you hear me?
I can.
All right, well, I know that this is ending, so I know that there's a game on right now, so I'm trying to catch some of that Spurs versus the Thunder. Very good game. And yeah, so yeah, anytime you guys want to do this again, we can, go from there. You guys can find me on social media, which we talked a little bit about social media. It's therapist underscore D Brooks on all platforms. I'm on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Lemonade, YouTube, on all that. So you guys can identify me there or check me out there. And that's that. The whole point of today was to discuss stigma and have more intricate revelations or to emphasize things that would limit some of these issues, especially when we're talking against ideas such as suicide or just things that prevent men from being able to be kind of be their whole selves. Yeah. All
Right.
right.
Thank you. All right, Professor Rod,
Yeah.
you have anything for next Tuesday? We won't have a show next Wednesday, and then
I'll
come
talk to
back.
them. I'm waiting on
Okay.
two people to confirm.
Yeah, and on the sixth, we have Dr. Inky coming back on
All right.
Wednesday. All right. Appreciate you, Daryl. Thanks,
All right.
brother.
Guys, have a
Professor
good one.
Ra.
All
Each
right.
one teach one and black conscious. All right.
That's right.
All right. Have a good one.
All right, my brothers.
Thank you.